Okay. So, as I mentioned, we have Professor Ruth Wood with us today. She is a senior lecturer in environment and climate change and a research fellow with the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research and the Centre for Climate and Social Transformations. Her research interests include the relationship between zero carbon society and infrastructure and its effect on demand, justice, and resilience to future climate change impacts. She was a lead author for the UK Climate Change Risk Assessment Technical Reports in 2022 and part of the Climate Services for a Net Zero Resilient World Now consortium to inform UK climate policy. So with that, Ruth, if you're ready, I'd love to hand over to you, and we really look forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Thank you very much, everybody. I'm really it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation to talk to you today. So I'm going to give you a run through of the background to the climate emergency. And just try and get my slides to move forward. The global targets that have been set, the challenges of meeting those global targets, where we're at the moment, and the consequences of our failure so far to mitigate sufficiently to avoid dangerous climate change and what that holds for the future. So just to give you a little bit more background to the climate emergency, where we're at the moment. So as you'll all be aware, the Earth's climate is driven primarily by energy from the sun, and the way that that energy from the sun moves in and out of our atmosphere, mediated in part by the surface albedo, but also the greenhouse effect. So that electromagnetic radiation is passing through the Earth's atmosphere. When it's reflected, some of that infrared radiation is then trapped by a number of gases to create what's known as the greenhouse effect. And that way that heat moves around the atmosphere and oceans is mediated then by wind and ocean currents. And that really gives us the distribution of different climatic zones that you'll see around the world today. So greenhouse gases absorbing in the infrared spectrum or heat effectively. And there are lots of gases in the atmosphere that do that. They include water vapor, carbon dioxide, ozone, methane, as well as the gases you'll be familiar with from the Kyoto Protocol, nitrous oxide, HFCs, SF6. And they give us that increase in surface temperature that we wouldn't have without them being there. A mean increase around 33 degrees centigrade on average. The greenhouse gases, which we're particularly interested in and particularly focusing on mitigating, are those controlled under the Kyoto Protocol. And they're primarily there because they both absorb in the IR spectra, but I also that they have a long lifetime in the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide is one everybody's be familiar with that lasts between tens to thousands of years, and I'll come back to that point later about why it differs. Methane arising primarily from anaerobic digestion, so that might be decomposition in landfill sites, in paddy fields, in agriculture production. It's also released as a byproduct in the oil and gas industry through leakage. Nitrous oxide lasts for 121 years, primary sources from agriculture. And then we've got hydrofluorocarbons, depending on the species, can last from days to hundreds of years in the atmosphere. And our perfluorocarbons, PFCs, which are much more stable and will be in the atmosphere for thousands of years once we put them up there. And finally, sulfur hexafluoride, used a lot in the electrical industry, 3,200 years. So once they're up there, they stay there for a very long time, contributing to that warming effect. The figure here just shows you the breakdown of those greenhouse gases and how they make up total greenhouse gases emitted globally over time. It's dominated by carbon dioxide, with methane as the next biggest source, and nitrous oxide. To finish it off, nitrous oxide has increased from the 1940s onwards, but is quite stable. And you can see, as a proportion, CO2 has remained pretty dominant throughout history. If we look at where they come from, those gases, around 73% of greenhouse gases come from energy use. So that's a combination of energy use in industry to make iron and steel, road transport, heating in buildings, electricity production for everything that we rely upon so much in our day-to-day lives. Aviation and shipping are really important sources, and they're in there too in that balance. And the next main source is from agriculture, forestry, and land use. So everything that's required to produce the food we eat, and also the kind of how we use land. The challenge at the moment is deforestation. So when we're losing forests, we're losing the carbon that's stored in those forests, and that's one of the significant contributors to global greenhouse gases. Where we look then of how they stack up over time, generally you can see upward trends over the last 30 years for all of those sources of gases. Electricity and heat and transport have increased significantly, whereas others have stayed relatively stable. We've not seen massive decreases. The dips you see in this figure are from the 2008 financial crisis and the 2020 COVID pandemic. They are the only the biggest impact that we've seen in the last 30 years on to actually reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. If we look then about where they come from around the world, it really depends how you allocate responsibility for emissions, whether you do that based on who is physically emitting those greenhouse gases, or whether you look at it from a view of consumption, whereby you look at who is consuming the goods and services which have been generated using those greenhouse gases. So the figure here really shows you the four major blocks of countries in the world are responsible for 60% of global emissions. That's USA, China, EU27, and India. And you can see their contribution to global greenhouse gases over the last 30 years as well. The solid line there is the territorial emissions. So those are the emissions which are physically produced in the boundaries, the geographical boundaries of that country. And the dotted line above that is based on consumption emissions per capita. So our consumption emissions are those carbon emissions embodied within the goods and services consumed by people within those countries. As America is at the top there for both territorial and consumption emissions, declining but stabilizing. EU 27 shows pretty slow but steady reductions. Its consumption emissions, similar to the US, are much higher than its territorial emissions. And then China, in the kind of the reddy orange colour there, has been climbing steadily over the last 20 years. And its consumption emissions, again, much lower here than its territorial emissions, partly because China exports a lot of the CO2 in China is generated in the production of the goods and services that are consumed elsewhere in the world. So thinking about then about the lifespan of CO2. So we took in the first slide, I mentioned that the different gases are kind of controlled because of their longevity in the atmosphere, as well as their warming. CO2 has a range of how long a different an individual atom of CO2 lasts for a different time in the atmosphere, and that's because it's driven by the global carbon cycle. So the arrows here show you the different fluxes between components of the carbon cycle. So we've got on the left-hand side, we've got the anthropogenic fluxes. So this is from burning coal, oil, gas reserves, and releasing that CO2 into the atmosphere. Along from that, the orange arrow going upwards is land use change. So, whenever you convert forestry to agriculture or agricultural land to development, there will be carbon emissions associated with that loss storage. So, those are the two main fluxes going into the atmosphere. And then as part of the natural cycles, some of that CO2 is taken up by land, so it's absorbed again by plants and trees. Some of it is absorbed by the oceans, and then the rest of it stays in the atmosphere. So that balance over time is leading to the amount that's left in the atmosphere is what we then experience in terms of those parts per million in the atmosphere. And this gives you kind of an indicator, this figure here gives you an indicator of the relative sources and sinks primarily of that carbon. So along the horizontal axis, you'll see above the axis the positive fluxes into the carbon cycle from fossil and land use change, and below that horizontal axis is the sinks, so the ocean sink, the land sink, and the atmosphere. And whatever the ocean and land can't take up is left in that atmosphere. And you can see those sinks, the ocean and land sinks, have increased over time. So they have been kind of, as we've been emitting more, there has been more CO2 pulled into those sinks. But ultimately, there's still too much staying in the atmosphere. So we can think of the carbon cycle as kind of this bathtub analogy, when if you think of a bath filling up, we've got our sources of carbon from fossil fuel combustion and deforestation running into the bath, and then our sinks of carbon are the drain, that land uptake, the ocean uptake is what's taking it out. And your bath level is really depends on that balance between those two sources. And I find this is an interesting way of seeing
Yeah.
over the last century and
That makes
more
sense.
how where everything's ended up. So on the left-hand side, you'll see the different sources of emissions or the contribution parts per million to the atmosphere from coal, oil, gas, cement, land use change going up, and where it's all gone. So the land sink includes forest, our ocean sink, side effect of it CO2 being absorbed into the oceans is ocean acidification, and then the side effect of the atmosphere absorbing that extra CO2 is effectively climate change and global warming. So over time, we've seen this real steep increase in parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, resulting from that disbalance between the emissions of CO2 and the ability of our sinks to absorb it. It's continuing to going up. And there's little the kind of the red wiggly lines is the kind of the fluxes that you see in spring and autumn as vegetation grows and then dies back in the autumn. So that relationship between emitted carbon and what we see in the atmosphere is what we then use to try and understand how climate change and the types of weather we might experience in the future relates to that amount of CO2. So the climate responds to what we call cumulative emissions. So all that carbon that's emitted and isn't being stored is accumulating up there. We have these accumulative emissions that have been up there for the last century and are growing every year. We add more and more CO2 to the atmosphere. And the figure here shows you the relationship between the cumulative total anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions from 1870 against the temperature anomaly relative to 1861 to 1880, the pre-industrial times. So it's a pretty linear relationship. The black dotted line, the black line there is actual emissions, historical emissions, and the different coloured lines there are scenarios of where future emissions might go to. And you can see that when cumulative emissions get somewhere between 500 and 1,000 CO2 emissions or gigatons, that leads to warming around 1.5 degrees global warming level. And then 2 degrees is a little bit above that. So depending on which scenario you use and which level of uncertainty you're comfortable with using for your modelling, we need to stay within, if you draw a line up from roughly 500, 750 gigatons of carbon, will get you hopefully to stabilise and avoid going over that critical threshold of 1.5 and 2 degrees. So those cumulative emissions are really important to consider when we think about how quickly we decarbonise and how we do it. Because every ton of carbon counts, whether it's produced now or in the future. And if we think about the embodied carbon, the carbon associated with the materials we use to build stuff, they are as important. Even if what we're building is a renewable energy source, the embodied carbon that's used to create it is still really important to consider. So these pie charts here give you an idea of taking that chart and putting it into some more tangible numbers. To have a likelihood, 50% likelihood of remaining below 1.5 degree, the carbon budget that we've already consumed is this 2,650 gigatons of CO2 over the last 100 years, and we've got 235 gigatons left that could be emitted globally before those models suggest that threshold will be breached. If we went slightly higher to trying to avoid 1.7 degrees, got 585 gigatons of CO2 remaining in our carbon budget. So the budgets are like, yeah, the budgets keep us within our warming levels. If we want to stay below a certain warming level, we have to stop our cumulative emissions at within that budget. And to stay below 2 degrees, we've got about 1,000 gigatons left. And if we compare that to the annual global emissions, that's kind of equivalent to 6, 14, and 27 years worth of global emissions. So that gives you an indication of how fast we need to get to zero to avoid going over those temperature thresholds. So moving on to those global targets and what those budgets mean for how we go about mitigating emissions. So at Paris, it was hailed as a success. There was international agreement there to hold global temperatures increase to well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels and pursue efforts to limit it to 1.5 degrees below pre-industrial levels. And as you'll see from the previous budgets, that's quite challenging. To meet those budgets and stay within those budgets, we basically need to get that black line, which is our measured emissions, to follow the green line if we want to avoid 1.5, the blue line for 1.7, and the red line for avoiding going above 2 degrees. So all of them require rapid and urgent reduction in CO2 emissions. And if you see this 1.5, it's coming, that getting to zero is really coming well before 2040. It's very, very rapid decline. The types of reductions in greenhouse gases we've seen historically haven't, with the kind of the types of events that have led to those types of levels of decline, have been things like COVID, global financial crisis, dissolution of the Soviet Union. So this figure here shows you the annual changes in global CO2 emissions over time. And you can see primarily they have been going up and up and up. And it's only during really global crises we see a reduction. We've got a massive rebound after the pandemic. You can see for 2021. It has come down a little bit, but we're still going up. Those annual changes are still there. So if we really want to meet those temperature limits, there's not a much of a positive precedent for delivering that scale of action. So if we want to deliver that scale of emission reduction, it really needs to be much more intentional, planned, and sustained to keep us on that downward trajectory. And we've not managed to do it so far at a global level, though individual countries have managed to do this. And there's a lot we can learn from them. You may also be aware that global average temperatures in 2024 were the warmest on record. So we went on about
Sustainable high energy
1.55
systems.
degrees C above pre-industrial was recorded last year. So we're very close to missing that 1.5 degree target. I mean, you've seen the figures and you can judge for yourselves whether you think reaching those emission reduction levels is feasible. So we have reached that 1.5 degree threshold for 1 year. In principle, they haven't defined within Paris what co counts as passing 1.5 degrees, whether it needs to be sustained for a period of time. Generally, we think about 20 to 30 years in climate scales. So whether it will be, it's kind of watching this space as to what this year's temperature records will be like, to see whether that we continue on that trend of breaching that 1.5 degree threshold. So delivery of the Paris Agreement. So the Paris Agreement set out these really aspirational targets for avoiding that 2.5 degrees and 1.5 degrees. To deliver it, what they ask countries to do is that every 5 years, each country submits a climate action plan known as a nationally determined contribution, or NDC. And in the NDCs, countries communicate actions they will take to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions in order to reach the goals of the Paris Agreement. So they are led, but at country level. It's up to individual countries about what contribution they are willing to make to support the delivery of the Paris Agreement. The United Nations Environment Programme every year evaluates those NDCs and the pledges that countries have made, and evaluates whether or not they will get us to the Paris Agreement and what level of warming they'd lock us into. So their latest report showed, if current decarbonisation policies across the world continue, there's a 66% chance we get around 3.1 degrees of warming relative to pre-industrial. If countries also deliver their unconditional NDCs, so unconditional is good, not got they've said they're going to do this without any strings attached. If those are delivered and get to 2.8 degrees, if the additional conditional NDCs are delivered, where countries have put I will only do this if so and so does this, or there's funding for this. If those are delivered, we get to 2.6 degrees. But if not only the conditional NDCs are delivered, but also all the net zero pledges around the world, then their modelling suggests we could, in principle, get to stabilising climate around 1.9 degrees, which does breach 1.5, but does skim under that 2 degree threshold. So there's a lot to get us from our current policies to the actual delivery of the conditional NDCs and all those net zero pledges. Around the world, the yellow countries here have got a net zero target in law. The blue countries have a net zero target in their policies, but they haven't put it into on a legal footing yet. And the kind of the orangey coloured countries have a political pledge to deliver net zero, but again, they haven't put it into law yet. So it's really, in principle, if all these countries followed through, we have an awful lot of countries that have set themselves up to deliver net zero. And that should contribute, if they are all successful in delivering that, to get us to that 1.9 degree threshold. It's all if they deliver what they've said they will. The challenge is that there's a net in that zero. So the figures I showed you before were to get to the pathways we need to do to get to zero carbon, so we don't go over our carbon budget. But this net has crept in. So the net basically is this concept of negative emissions. So if you can't mitigate your greenhouse gases at a fast enough rate to get to absolute zero, you can net them off by using negative emissions technology. So the figure here really shows you that concept. The kind of the area under zero is where many countries and many modelling exercises are thinking of, like, we can offset continued growth in CO2 emissions or failure to mitigate through those negative emissions technologies. And it has some merit in that there are some sectors which are incredibly difficult to mitigate. So there are not a lot of options to reduce, for example, emissions from food production. There will be some, we will need to eat, and there will be some emissions associated with that. There are some sectors which are, might be trickier or take a longer time to decarbonize than others. And in theory, if you could net off those emissions, so to give them more space to make that transition over time, that provides a good buffer. So the negative emissions technologies include things like biomass carbon capture and storage, where you grow a tree, that tree has stored carbon in it, you burn it for energy, but in doing so, you capture the CO2 emitted during that combustion and store it, usually in a deep, in an old oil field or in a saline aquifer, somewhere where it can be stored on geological time frames. Other technologies out there are direct air capture and storage, where they're effectively filtering CO2 out of the air and storing it permanently. There's also interest around ocean-based measures, such as alkalinization and filtering out CO2 from seawater as well. And then there's some more land-based measures for the use of biochar, which can store carbon, helps soils store more carbon. So there are a range of different measures which are being proposed to deliver that net element in net zero. I think the challenge that's been pointed out is that they are quite niche, and the scale at which they can store carbon is quite small in comparison to our global emissions. So the central picture is a direct air capture site that's in operation. It's currently storing about 0.001 megatons of carbon per year. Just a very small fraction of our global emissions. And similarly, and the more farming land-based practices there are very small as well. Whereas reforestation actually has quite significant globally, forestation and reforestation stores a lot of carbon emissions in comparison. So those net emissions technologies, they might be very useful in an emergency, but they're not the things you rely upon to deliver your major emission reductions. They are there for mopping up where you really, really cannot get any lower. So the critical mitigation actions, you will all be aware of. We've got to reduce demand and waste, increase resource efficiency, decarbonize electricity supply, electrify heat and surface transport where possible, using carbon capture storage for industrial process emissions such as cement, steel manufacturer, as well as switching to more sustainable materials. We need to eliminate HFCs and FF6 and replace them with more sustainable climate benign alternatives, halt deforestation, restore, reforest, afforest, and also tackle reducing greenhouse gases from food production. There are many individual technologies and examples of behavioural change and practice changes within this, but these are the kind of the headline things we know we need to do, and the technologies, the know-how is out there to do it. So, the consequences of failing to mitigate. We're in a critical decade. There's been a lots of discussion so far about how to mitigate. We know how to mitigate. We've just got to get on and do it and deliver it and sustain it. However, depending on where we go over the next 10, 20 years, we'll have different consequences to deal with. So a lot of my research now works on climate impacts and climate impact assessments. So we know the physical climate impacts associated with a warming world. So if you've got a warming climate, you have warmer land, air and oceans, you've got melting of ice and glaciers, increasing sea levels, changes in ocean currents, changes in hydrological cycles, and more extreme weather. So you'll be familiar with those types of changes to the climate that are there. And despite, as we've said, despite efforts so far to to mitigate. The current projections put the world, I'd say, roughly on track for between 1.5 and 2 degrees of global warming by 2050, up to 3.1 by the end of the century if current policies are followed and we fail to meet those NDCs and we don't, the countries that have pledged to become net zero don't do that. So if we keep on current policies, that's the picture we're looking at. Hopefully we won't, but every fraction of a degree counts. The more quickly and urgently we can mitigate, the better. Mitigation is more urgent than ever. With a caveat to that, we also need to be thinking, if you're risk averse, that we need a backup plan to be able to deliver net zero in a changing climate. So making sure that our mitigation efforts are not derailed by extreme weather events, all these other things that are happening. So the main climate hazards we can you'd be aware of, you've got these hotter average and extreme summer temperatures, so heat waves getting hotter, more prolonged, higher extreme temperatures leading to things like increased wildfire risk, drought on the other end of the spectrum, intense rainfall periods, contributing to both surface water and river flooding, landslips, slope failures, kind of get pretty catastrophic slope failures from dams or from old spoil heaps, shrinks our subsidence of that combination between two dry soils, two wet soils. Wind speeds, these are UK changes here. The impacts are really interesting around the world. They differ a lot. In the UK, we've got an increase in near surface wind speeds, particularly during winter. Increased frequency of winter storms and an increased frequency in extreme low wind events as well. So both end of the spectrums to deal with. So imagine you're a wind turbine operator. You've got to deal with that uncertainty as to when your wind turbines have to be turned off for safety reasons because the wind speeds are too high, but also those days when it's too low to operate. Sea level rise. And conversely to that, though, there's the reduction in snowfall, frost days, and heating degree days. So our winters generally will get warmer. But it's not just those individual climate hazards we need to think about. Each of those climate impact drivers in this diagram here, I've borrowed from the IPCC, each of those climate hazards I've talked about has knock-on consequences throughout the rest of the system. So if we think about drought, and impacts on water supply, increase on food impacts on food production, how that in turn interacts with people's livelihoods and their ability to sustain income if they're subsistence farming, contributes. Those drought events and heat waves events can cause significant health problems and increasing mortality rates, knock-on consequences for well-being. Migration and forced displacements for people who can't, for whom where they live is either going to be under the sea or where they are no longer able to make an economic living in that area. So this map gives you all those kind of those interactions. So it's when we think about climate impacts, it's not just those physical changes in weather that we need to be thinking about. It's all those knock-on consequences across the systems and across every aspect of our daily life, effectively. So it leads us on to identifying climate risks. So, as part of planning for mitigation and part of planning to become more sustainable, in doing that, we need to also think about the climate risks and ensure those decisions are robust to future climate change. So, in terms of identifying climate risk, risks are kind of defined as the potential for adverse consequences of a climate-related hazard on lives, livelihood, health and well-being, ecosystems and species, and more. So lots of impacts to think about. And that level of risk depends on the interactions between the vulnerability of that affected system you're thinking about, the exposure of it, how frequently is it going to be exposed to a particular hazard, and what that hazard is. And that's really what we do a lot in that climate impact assessment, looking at the vulnerability of infrastructure, the vulnerability of assets, of systems, as well as the climate data to help us understand how regularly those systems are going to be exposed to different events and how they're able to manage those. So we think about any time we do an impact assessment, we think about that vulnerability. So the vulnerability is defined by the IPCC as the propensity to be adversely affected. So how badly off would a system be if it was affected by a particular hazard? And that is embedded within that the idea of sensitivity, susceptibility to harm, and capacity to adapt. So sensitivity here is basically the degree to which a system or species is affected by a climate hazard. And then adaptive capacity is that ability of that system or that individual to take action to keep them safe from harm. So you think about it in the concept of a heat wave, a sense your sensitivity as an individual sensitivity to a heat wave will be affected by your age, your health, whether you have any underlying health conditions, what you're doing, whether you're working outside, whether you're in an air-conditioned building, and your adaptive capacity, your ability to change your behaviour to cope with that hot weather. Do you have the resources to not be working outside in hot weather? Do you have the resources to stay in a building where you can keep yourself cool? Do you have access to cold water, cold showers, all those other things that can help you better able to manage that hot weather? And those three concepts you can apply to any infrastructure, any activities, research tasks. And we do this to try and understand and unpack not just where people are vulnerable, but also where you can target adaptation actions to reduce vulnerability to those climate hazards, either by reducing people's sensitivity or reducing the system sensitivity or by enhancing adaptation. So we tend to think about climate impact assessments going from thinking about the physical risks from climate hazards to a given place or activity. So this could be a research site, it could be a piece of equipment, it could be an activity you do on that piece of equipment. But we also think about risks to people, the occupants, the people who are conducting the research, doing that activity. We think about the impacts on the power supply, the water supply, ICT, material supply chains. So, for example, semiconductor materials primarily come from Taiwan, which has had a drought for a number of years now, and it's a very water-intensive industry to be generating those semiconductors. So, it's within your scope of control. It's also thinking about your key material supply chains, where your rare earth metals are coming from, where are you getting equipment from, how is it getting there? There's lots of reliance on some key ports. If the ports are out of action due to a storm or sea level rise, then how do we get places from one to the other? For remote research sites, how do you access those sites if there's a flood and there's only one road in and one road out? But there's also the socioeconomic risks resulting from the hazards more widely. So we're never assessing risk in on its own theory. It is going to be happening at a time where there are going to be that same event is happening across the world or across the country. And there will be consequences from that. So economic disruption, political disruption, poverty, inequality exacerbated by these events happening. If we think about doing those climate impacts, I've reviewed many climate impact assessments. And one of the challenges is climate data and getting good data to really understand where your risk lies. And we need to move away. There's lots of research that's looked at averages of climate change, average temperatures, averages. And those averages, when they're presented as global mean change, daily or yearly average, hide an awful lot. When you average some of these things out, they sound really quite innocuous. I mean, 1.5 degrees of change, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Slightly warmer in winter, slightly warmer in summer. It sounds really innocuous, but it's not. They really obfuscate that, the potential impact of the weather within that warm climate. And so we need to think about more about those extreme events, because it's those extreme events that have the most impact, and they're not really well represented in the climate data that's often used for these impact assessments. So I'm just going to end with a few examples of that before concluding. So when we think about this global average surface temperature, the figure on the left shows you how that global average surface temperature has increased over time, and that anomaly. But actually, it's not increased universally around the world. The oceans have warmed slower than land surfaces. The northern hemisphere has been warming faster than the southern hemisphere. So even when we think about 1.5 degrees of global warming, actually it's not that everywhere. We in Europe and in parts of North America, it's warmed at much faster rate than that global average. And if we look at the future and we look at projected temperatures, that equally shows a different distribution. So the northern hemisphere warming much faster than the equatorial regions and the southern hemisphere. So this, the figure at the top is the alarming one. That's the 4 degrees worth of global warming compared to the 1.5 degrees warming at the bottom of this figure. But there are distributions around the world that we need to be more mindful of when we think about some of these impacts. And then another observation is yearly precipitation averages are sometimes used, but a lot can happen in a year. If you're just being given by a climate scientist a yearly precipitation, I would want to know more, because within the same year you can have a drought and a flood because the rainfall intensity has changed. Similarly, we can talk about temperatures. Temperatures fluctuate throughout the day. We have warmer temperatures in daytime, colder temperatures at night. And when you want to understand your heat exposure when you're working during the day, or how much you need to cool down equipment or a laboratory, it's those daytime temperatures that are the peak ones that we need to be thinking about. But those daily averages hide that distinction. So when if you think about assessing the risks of your experiments, your facilities, or your activities to these climate hazards, really think about that, those ranges of exposure and those ranges and fluctuations of things, not just averages over time. So I'll end there, but in summary, it's an emergency. Every fraction of a degree counts. Mitigation is more critical than ever, and we need to get on with it rapidly now. But we also need to adapt and become resilient to future climate change, because we're likely locked into around 1.5 degrees of warming at least, if not more. And all the different range of weather that's hidden within that statistic, hidden within that 1.5 degree number. So if you're thinking about improving the sustainability of the research element, part of that I recommend is not only decarbonising, but it's also being resilient to those future physical climate averages. And to do that, we need to think beyond those averages and really think about how the variation is impacting what we're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ruth. That was really interesting and a really great overview of all of the, well, the scenarios and terrifying potential that this will this wicked problem will cause us if we really don't step up, quite simply. So we now have around 15 minutes for questions, for discussion. I already see a hand up, so I will let you unmute yourself, Zach, if you'd like to, and if please do ask a question.
Thanks, Hannah. Thanks, Ruth. This was a really interesting talk, and there's a lot of really nice stuff in there. I have one very naive question. I think we're kind of spoiled in HEP by having Indico for all our meetings and CERN e-groups for all our email lists and like the archive where all the papers get posted. So it's kind of easy for me to keep track of what's going on in the community. When a new recommendation comes down, if I care about it, I can get informed very quickly by one of those mechanisms. I have a really hard time when somebody, like you did with averages, says, you know, this is the old way of doing things. It's a little silly. We know we can do a lot better than just taking averages. Somewhere, someone will now come up with a recommendation. And I don't know how I can find out when that recommendation comes down, what it is, how to apply it to my work. You know, there was also the idea of marginal carbon cost in power terms. And if I reduce my carbon consumption, what is the carbon that I saved by doing that? There's a working group on that that I know of, but I have no idea where they report. I have no idea once the answer comes out what happens. So how can I keep myself informed about the latest in these sorts of things that I should apply to how I think about climate change and carbon?
That's a good question. It depends how long you want to spend keeping yourself updated. I mean, I think the challenge is the IPCC have regular updates, but their reports are thousands of pages long. And realistically, reading through those is a lot. Depending on the country you're based in, they will have different standards and different guidance, because for it's like the MAC, the CO2 cost will really differ where depending where you are in the world. In the UK, the government reports and gives an annual update on the latest CO2 figures from various things and emission factors. We also have every 2 years a climate impacts report, which comes out with an adaptation plan. So I can tell you, probably give you a list of places within the UK very easily, but a lot of it will come down to the individual country you're based in and where they are reporting the country-specific risks and hazards. Because the IPCC, I appreciate, is a mammoth task to read through. Places like Carbon Brief, NOAA, are always good sources of information, I think, that's digestible.
Thank you.
Brilliant, thank you. I think the next hand up was from Claire, if you'd like to unmute yourself.
Yes, hi, thanks. Okay, I feel like I have an even more naive question. Because you said at the end of your presentation how you need more data would be useful on different sectors, and but the charts you showed were all focused on carbon dioxide. And I was wondering what the reason, I mean, why are there not as many studies on the other greenhouse gases, or is it just more worth focusing on carbon dioxide as the largest slice?
So I have to confess to cheating. So the global carbon budget produce a wonderful slide pack, which give you the CO2 emissions globally over time, and they give you every year they could create an update. So the Global Carbon Project are one of the major sources of information for carbon data. That level of information on the other gases, nitrous oxide and methane and the others, is less, it's harder to get hold of at a re where it's regularly updated and regularly presented. But there are similarly high-level studies of how you decarbonize and how you reduce the greenhouse gases from agriculture, for example. There's a lot of research in that space. There's a lot of research in waste management and how you reduce methane emissions from different places. So I kind of emphasize CO2 more because I'm more familiar with it, and it's kind of, in a way, the easier gas to reduce. because it's embedded within our energy system and within our construction sector. So steel, cement, and energy kind of covers most of your CO2 emissions. So if you focus on reducing those, that's a really good start. But there are equally lots of reports which focus on the other gases and how to reduce those. And if you're interested in that, I can send a variety of links to those other sources.
Okay, thanks.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Shirasi, I think you have your hand up next.
Hello.
Oh,
Can
no.
you hear me? Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, maybe speak a little louder.
Now? Now, now?
Yeah, I think it works.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot. That was such an excellent talk. And like super like interesting. Could you go to the slide where you had the countries which had put the laws into place and the others which had them in their policies?
I'll just work out how to share again. Is it this one?
Yeah. Yes. So my question was, it's mostly, I guess, Canada, Australia, and countries in Europe and Russia, which have put the policies into laws. And the other countries which technically uses most of the fossil fuels, that are US, India, China, and I think Iran and Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, which are one of the most like biggest oil exporters, they have it in the policy, not implemented yet. And some of them have just pledged it. So, in terms of the fact that if governments do not take it upon themselves to decarbonize the systems themselves, like realistically, what kind of chances do you think do we have that? I mean, we can reach a 1.9 or 2.6 target, for example, like the lower ones.
So, if these countries don't deliver on what they've
Yeah.
pledged,
Yeah.
I mean, from the UN GAP report, I think if we deliver the NDCs, the national defined contributions, then it's around 2 point. I should go back a slide, see what that was, but it's around 2.6 degrees if they got all those. So if countries don't deliver on net zero, you're kind of going back up this chart here of if we just get the NDCs between 2.6 and 2.8, but even that does require effort from countries to change their current policies to deliver on their NDCs.
Yeah, and are like is it ongoing? Like, is it going as expected?
In terms of delivering on their policies.
Yeah.
So I think it depends which countries you look at. Europe is probably roughly on track. It's a bit of a, I think the current political climate is a bit of a minefield because there's been lots of backlash against net zero globally. It's in the UK and in other countries. So I think this couple of years is going to be really critical to see what direction we go in, whether there is a whole fast line to delivering net zero or it goes off track.
Okay.
I think it's really difficult to say. I mean, I've been working on climate mitigation for a long time. There's been lots of talking and lots of research, but not a lot of delivery. aside from a few stellar countries which really are showing us how to do it. If only they could be replicated.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. I see also Ali has his hand up. I also have a question, but I'll hold off.
Right, so it should be appearing in a second now. Hi. Thanks for the talk. It was a great overview. I'm interested in both a sort of follow-up from one of the previous questions, but also a slide you showed where the major events that had a significant change in our carbon dioxide output globally were economic failures, for want of a better catch-all term. So, what do you think the possibilities are of applying legal solutions to achieve some meaningful reduction? Because I don't think practically we can just have economic collapse as our sort of pathway forward.
I do.
So, yeah.
Yes, I think there's lots of scope for legal requirements. Putting in standards, putting in targets, binding measures, delivery mechanisms, there's lots of scope for doing that.
Do you think there's any scope for bringing legal action
Oh,
to,
actually.
yes?
Yeah, so I think there have been some test cases around the world where either groups have taken local authorities or local governments to court for disruption due to environmental events. I think there is lots going on in that space, to try and encourage countries to fulfill their obligations or fulfill their targets. So I think we'll see in time how those pan out, but there's definitely a whole group of organizations which are pursuing that those legal measures.
Yeah, it kind of it's kind of interesting. I'm sort of wondering what the levers are available for actually actioning change, meaningful change. And so, yeah, I was wondering if there'd been any more developments in the legal sphere.
I'm sure there have been. The ones I'm aware of have been kind of people who've bought homes in floodplains where the planning authority knew they were in a floodplain. They have collectively sued the local authority for giving planning permission to build in a floodplain. There have been test cases of demonstrating impact on health due to different activities which have been successful. But I'm not up to date on whether there are any big mass actions on climate targets at the moment. But I'm sure there are. It was very much there's a lot of talking about attribution, event attribution. So attributing particular climate events and weather events to climate change and then suing large emitters for causing them. There's been a lot of interest and discussion around that space.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Brilliant, thank you. I guess I'll ask one probably quite quick question. It was in your very like pretty early slides, actually, maybe around slide five. You showed the difference between the consumption and the territorial emissions. And I was quite surprised at the huge differences between, for example, China Europe, and the US. They had a huge difference that wasn't accounted for, for example, the opposite trend for China. And I guess my question is that because a lot of smaller countries have, I guess, a lot less.
Similar
Okay, yeah.
deficit.
I see you nodding
Yeah.
already. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They will be the rest of the world also trading with those countries and having a deficit similar to China, where they export more than they export more carbon effectively than they emit and use themselves.
Okay. I mean, maybe this is probably beyond the scope of this conference, but then how do we change that?
So I think some of the change has come from effectively offshoring, exporting particular manufacturing capabilities, production capabilities. And because labor is cheap, has been cheaper historically. But if we think more carefully about, do we need to, like, overconsumption is one of the big trends behind this. We consume far more than we need. So reducing consumption in general is always going to reduce those consumption emissions. And being mindful as individuals and organizations, having sustainable procurement policies where we procure equipment from low carbon sources, low carbon providers. And there's also been lots of research on kind of carbon border tax adjustments, where you place a carbon tax when something enters a country. But I don't think they have got that far into being implemented yet. But from an organizational individual perspective, it's about reducing consumption and then having those sustainable procurement policies whereby you only buy from a supplier where they can demonstrate that they have a sustainable supply chain, a low carbon supply chain.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order, isn't it? But okay, thank you so much. I guess, with that, I think we've come to time. So once again, thank you so much. I'll encourage everyone to virtually give a round of applause to Ruth. So thank you so much. We really appreciate you spending time with us this morning or this afternoon, depending on your time zone. I see a lot of clapping hands in the Zoom. So we really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay, so next on the agenda is Professor Caterina Vernieri. I think I saw